Thank you for downloading this Great Lives podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information and details of other podcasts, just visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello and welcome to Bristol and to the More Than Words Festival, Radio 4's first ever listening festival. Our subject on Great Lives is a wordsmith, a brilliant writer of plays and verse, whose work has, in the 6 decades since his death, been largely overwhelmed by the myths that surround his life. I think it's fair to say that as a writer, he's been a bit out of fashion. But to me, he's a genius. So I'm delighted that Dylan Thomas, or blubber-lipped, gooseberry-eyed Welsh poet Thomas, as Time magazine so rudely described him just before he died, is our great life today. Perhaps, and perhaps tediously, as famous for his wild boy drinking as for his literary output, Thomas was only 39 at the time of his death, but not before he'd written this, Under Milk Wood, the opening read here by his fellow countryman, Richard Burton.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow-black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush, the babies are sleeping. The farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobblers, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the webfoot, cockle women, and the tidy wives.
Fantastic. I remember listening to that as a youth in southern Rhodesia on the radio and immediately understanding it and loving it, accessible without being cheap. My guest, who's chosen the author of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Dog and wonderful verse such as Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, is Owen Shears. Owen's output in his short career includes 2 collections of poetry, the novels, The Dust Diaries and Resistance, which was recently made into a film, and A Poet's Guide to Britain, which accompanied his series on BBC Radio 4. He's also currently writer-in-residence with the Welsh Rugby Union and grew up in Abergavenny. Born in Fiji, grew up in Abergavenny, some 40 miles from here across the River Severn, as the crow black crow flies. I'm so pleased you can join us, Owen. When did you first come across Dylan Thomas?
I realised the other day the first time that I would have heard some of his work was actually when my mother used to sing us to sleep. She played Polly Garter at a production of Under Milk Wood in Newport in the early 70s. And she used to sing me to sleep with Tom, Dick and Harry, our 3 fine men. Some might argue a slightly strange song to sing your child to sleep with, but there we are, she did. And then after that, I do have a very clear memory. I mean, it almost sounds too good to be true, but sort of sitting in the orchard and reading poems such as Fern Hill and certainly Under Milk Wood at that stage. And then even some of the not-so-well-known poems, such as In My Craft or Sullen Art, for example, which definitely made an immediate impact on me. I think even before I could really understand the narrative logic of them.
We aim on this programme to tackle both the life and the work, and you said when we were talking to you earlier that there were some myths that you wanted to bust, such as?
Well, it's partly about busting myths, but it's also about remembering him as a poet and remembering the poems. Thomas is not an example of a great life, unfortunately. A slightly sordid, extraordinary and a tragic life, which gave birth to great work. But certainly one myth that I am keen to bust is the idea that he ever wrote anything other than stone cold sober, because I've seen no evidence that he ever wrote drunk. And I don't think that you could write those poems drunk. And it wasn't in his personality. You know, I mean, he was a poetry geek. He was writing, you know, verses at the back of the class in school. He loved it. He thrived off it.
He clearly had a conflicted personality. Listen to this. I hold a beast, an angel, and a madman in me. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I think, you know, there's an element of the Thomas exaggeration and the Thomas showman in that statement. But I think that there's also a huge amount of self-knowledge. He was a conflicted person. I'm not sure that he was ever a person who ever felt rooted or at home anywhere.
Before we return to some of this, can I introduce Damian Walford Davies from Aberystwyth University, who's general editor of the forthcoming Oxford Literary History of Wales. Damien, there's no doubting the Welshness of Dylan Thomas, at least not to an Englishman. But something that amazed me was how plummy he now sounds. Here he is, talking on the BBC about the little Welsh village most closely associated with his name.
Now, some people live in Lunn because they were born in Lunn and saw no good reason to move. Others migrated here for a number of curious reasons, from places as distant and improbable as Tonopendy or even England, and have now been absorbed by the natives. Some entered the town in the dark and immediately disappeared, and can sometimes be heard on hushed black nights making noises in ruined houses. Or perhaps it is the white owls breathing close together like ghosts in bed. Others have almost certainly come here to escape the international police or their wives. And there are those, too, who still do not know and will never know why they are here at all. You can see them any day of the week, slowly, dopily wandering up and down the streets like Welsh opium eaters, half asleep in a heavy, bewildered day. And some, like myself, just came one day for the day and never left. Got off the bus and forgot to get on again.
Damien, those slightly plummy tones, did they start as an affectation?
No, they didn't. I mean, they're coming from a very particular cultural location, really. I mean, we have to remember that Thomas was born in what he called the ugly, lovely town of Swansea. But it's important to remember also which part of Swansea he comes from, because that's very, very important. He doesn't come from the industrial east. He comes from the aspiring middle, upper middle class uplands area. And he was born, obviously, and you couldn't make that name up, Cwm Donkin Drive. It's a fantastic name. And in a sense, he has to work his way out of Cwm Donkin Drive. So very early on, he had elocution lessons. And this was obviously part of the Anglophone, Anglophile culture of Swansea. Welsh, obviously, which his father spoke, and which obviously his forebears from rural Carmarthenshire spoke, was something that his family had not decided to pass on to him. And one can debate whether he felt that as a kind of lack throughout his life.
He had a very strange relationship with Wales, and it's not unusual. I have a number of Welsh friends who are very Welsh indeed, and yet who, in the most vituperative way, let fly at the country which made them. What is it about Wales that makes some of its sons and daughters love and hate it so much at the same time?
Well, it's passion, isn't it, see? It's always all or nothing. No, actually, I suppose I would slightly counter that argument by saying that I've also experienced that from people who come from other parts of Britain, and perhaps it's something that we feel about the places that give birth to us. It's, you know, where we're from. I mean, Thomas wrote a very interesting broadcast, Welsh Artists, in which he does kind of satirise himself in London, you know, and he talks about that plummy accent. But at the end of it, I feel he strikes a very serious note. He says, actually, the main problem is that the Welsh artist tends to talk too much about being Welsh. And actually, the only thing that matters is being an artist. And as he says, the only position for an artist is upright. Not something he always achieved, to be fair. But, you know, so I can imagine him feeling somewhat sort of claustrophobic. But also, undoubtedly, Wales was where, you know, he drew so much of his writing from. If you go and visit the boat shed in Larne and you look out, there is all of Thomas's writing. Certainly all of his best writing is there in that view, and it's in the rhythms of the people in the town. So, but I think it's a love-hate relationship, as you call it, which, as I said, is both experienced by people who are very much rooted anywhere, but also perhaps by writers who don't want to be hemmed in by borders and yet are aware that in some way they do actually draw their energy, their power from that place.
Describe the man, Damien. What did he look like?
Well, born in 1914, let me give you three images of him. He's growing up as an angel. I mean, he's got this halo of golden hair. And if you see, some of you in the audience here will know some of these early photos of him. He looks absolutely angelic. Then there's a wonderful sketch of him, which he himself gives in a 1947 return journey, it's called, a broadcast, BBC broadcast, where he imagines going back to Swansea almost as a ghost. And you can see where Undermilk Wood comes from and some of those disembodied voices in Undermilk Wood, trying to find his lost self, his Welsh self, perhaps, certainly his earlier self. And he goes up, this particular section in the bar, and he accosts a barmaid and says, this Thomas, I'm trying to find this Thomas geezer, as it were. And the barmaid said, well, what does he look like then? And narrator, which is Thomas, of course, says, oh, well, he'd be about 17 or 18. And above medium height for Wales, I mean. He's 5'6½". And here we go, thick blubber lips, snub nose, curly mouse brown hair. Mouse brown, you see the golden halo has turned mouse brown, which actually happened. One front tooth broken after playing a game called Cats and Dogs in The Mermaid Mumbles. Absolutely true. Speaks rather fancy. Truculent, plausible, a bit of a show-off, plus fours and no breakfast, you know. And then the barmaid signs off, says, there's words. What do you want to find him for? And then the third, and it's a rather depressing third portrait of him. He gets married to Caitlin, whom we'll be talking about, I'm sure, in a minute, in 1937. And then 1938, you start hearing that the weight is piling on. And from then on, it was a sad decline, physically a different man. He is a different man. And, of course, he dies at 39.
Drink was a huge issue for him, and I think it was, you know, hugely compounded with his early trips to America. Because you have to remember, this was a post-war Britain, which was very frugal. He went over to New York, already a fledgling star, and the embrace of that city was absolutely suffocating.
Do you think it was a persona that, to some extent, he cultivated because he thought that's what an artist has to be like?
Mm. I think that's probably true. Certainly when he goes to London, up to London in 1934... literally with a sheaf of papers in his hands. You know, he goes there to peddle his wares. Ultimately, he gets published in London in 34. But there were friends around him who didn't look after him in that sense and asked him to perform as the bibulous Welshman, you know. He hated himself for it and recognised that. But there was also a part of Thomas that was naturally ebullient. He was a great mimic. And, you know, one would have loved to be there when he was mimicking all these other poets. Also politicians, film stars, he was really tuned into popular culture as well.
Mm. It's interesting, actually. Seamus Heaney talks about him as being the buck leper at the Anglo-Saxon court. And I think it's a very valid question. Did that start with Thomas or did that start with the publishing industry within London? Mm. But whoever it started with, I mean, I'm amazed that the extent to which it did establish the idea, not just of the poet, but of the Welsh poet. I mean, I can't tell you how many times, if I'm saying, actually, I'm fine, I've had enough, people say, God, call yourself a Welsh poet. yes. Whereas actually, there were many more alcoholic English novelists, but no one ever says, call yourself an English novelist. So it certainly has sort of, it set that idea, and I think it fits into sort of a Dionysian idea, that we like our artists who have this sort of a privileged witness. In a way, perhaps we want them to pay for it in some way.
Damien, tell us a bit about his wife.
Caitlin McNamara, where do you start with Caitlin? that was a family you would sometimes wish to be around, sometimes you'd run a mile. Her father was a very interesting character, Francis McNamara. He was part of an Anglo-Irish family with nationalist sympathies. Like Dylan, he wasn't the most presentist, should we say, father. And he was perfectly willing for Caitlin and the other siblings to live a kind of strangely bohemian life with the family of that old goat, Augustus John, one of the great 20th century artists, but an old goat nevertheless, who was basically Caitlin's sugar daddy.
Her sister later described her as a honeypot for men. Mm. Was that true?
It certainly was true. Dylan Thomas was a honeypot for both men and women, as indeed was Caitlin. These were deeply attractive, earthy people, definitely. Very, very different in many ways. There was something ethereal people say about Dylan. There was something very physical about Caitlin. And so both, I think, complemented each other excellently. But also, you know, when they were literally throwing knives at each other in the kitchen in Larne, you would not want to be there, would you?
No. And they were obviously sexually curious. When I went to New York in 2003, I got the chance to interview the sculptor David Slivka, who actually made Thomas's death mask. And he told me this incredible story about how, first of all, Caitlin came to him and said, well, look, you know, actually what Dylan really wants to see is a lesbian sex show. You know? And then about half an hour later, he came to her and said, well, actually what Caitlin really wants to see is a lesbian sex show. So poor old David was tasked with finding some young women. But of course, it never happened because they both got so drunk, they started a massive bar fight. But considering that this was 1953, I mean, it just reminds you how much on the bohemian edge of things they were, perhaps.
Here she is, talking years after his death, describing him.
Dylan looked certainly not what my idea of a beautiful man was, which was tall, dark and handsome. He was sort of small, round and curly, you know. So it seemed an awful kind of come down. I couldn't really take him seriously as a man in the romantic sense. You know, he was really sweet and charming, and I was really fond of him. I must have been in love with him, you know. We were very close and all that. But it was something quite different. It wasn't like a man and a woman, you know, and I kept wanting to be sort of the little woman surrendering. I simply couldn't do that with Dylan. I think I was the one on top with Dylan. If he hadn't been a big artist or a writer or a poet or something, wouldn't have bothered with him at all. I'm sure of that.
That's a little chilling, her saying that she wouldn't have bothered with him if he hadn't been a big artist, a poet or a writer.
I think she's being a little disingenuous
there.
I mean, the attraction was immediate from both sides. They met in would you believe it, a London pub, the Wheatsheaf, and in 1936, and they got married a year afterwards. So this was an immediate bond, and it was, you've got to remember, I mean, they were trying to kill themselves pretty regularly, kill each other rather, pretty regularly.
Did they know they were trying to kill each other? Do you think there was a point in both their lives when they realised that they were not going to live to be old men, old women, and they just decided to die in style and slowly and in front of a lot of people?
Well, we have to say that both lives were, as Owen said earlier, deeply, deeply tragic. In many ways, brutish. We have to recognise that. And I think brutish is the word. And yet both of them recognised that there was this bond between them that they were very worried about losing. I mean, even with all the infidelities, and God knows there were scores of infidelities on both sides, and yet Dylan, for example, was very, very worried about losing Caitlin.
Mm. Oh, and I said earlier on that, for me, he was accessible, but he wasn't always accessible. Could I just read something and ask you a little test here, whether you think you know what it means? It sounds lovely, but I don't know what it means. Light breaks where no sun shines, where no sea runs, the waters of the heart push in their tides, and broken ghosts with glowworms in their heads, the things of light, file through the flesh where no flesh decks the bones. It's awfully easy to sing to in tone, but it is, I'm afraid, meaningless to me.
It's the conception of a child. You know, I mean, Thomas wanted to write about...
Oh, Lord, yes, you're quite right. Do you know I read it without realising it?
It's a bit handy to have a poet around in there, isn't it? But the fact that there was huge kind of outcry when that was first published, because... and many readers thought that some of the later verses were obscene. You know, they thought that he was really sort of, you know, pushing the boundaries too far. And then Thomas said, well, I don't know what they're talking about. That's a metaphysical image about grief and rain.
The lines you're talking about, Owen, do have the words gushing and rod in them.
And spouting.
And spouting, yeah. And he says, as Owen's just suggested, that it's actually a metaphysical conceit. That was published in The Listener, I think, and promptly the BBC banned it, banned my poems from being read. Of course, BBC never banned Dylan Thomas. No.
Can we talk about the BBC? Because he did an awful lot for the BBC. Was he sort of discovered by the BBC, or was he making his name already?
Well, the BBC, I think, recognised something new. Mm. And Dylan Thomas was one of these pioneers. He was one of the great democratisers of the voice and of high and low culture. Mm. And one of the great, you know, disseminators of culture on the radio, on the airwaves. We forget also, of course, about his involvement with television. I mean, he is not merely a prose writer or a poet. He's a screenwriter, script writer, the writer of documentaries, the writer of kind of glorified, aestheticized public information films. So there's a range there that we need to get back to, I think. Mm. So the myths that we need to bust involve getting us back to the full range of his brilliance, really.
Here's one of his producers at the BBC, Douglas Cleverdon, offering a very different view to the standard alcoholic picture many of his biographers usually paint.
In everything that concerned the spoken word on radio, he was impeccably professional. One gets rather tired of unending stories of his drunkenness, which was often imposed upon him by his hangers-on. In my own BBC experience, he was invariably sober and conscientious during rehearsals. I've known him leave his fellow drinkers in a pub at lunchtime in order to get back to the studio and study his part before the afternoon rehearsal.
And death shall have no dominion. Dead men naked, they shall be one with the man in the wind and the west moon. When their bones are picked clean and the clean bones gone, they shall have stars at elbow and foot. Though they go mad, they shall be sane. Though they sink through the sea, they shall rise again. Though lovers be lost, love shall not, and death shall have no dominion.
He would do all the things that you expected a bohemian to do, like break into your room in the middle of the night with jockeys and boxers and derelict solicitors and gramophones and expect you to start a party on the spot at 3 a.m. You know, what do you want to sleep for? Get up, I mean, let's have a bit of fun.
Let's look at the final years of his life. His wife said that it was America that really killed him, and you've been saying the same thing. She reckoned that he went on tours of America just in order to clear his bills, and the tours were a huge success, but they were also killing him. Is that right?
They certainly were. I mean, let's remember that he went 4 times to the States, and he was driven by economic need, certainly. There was a part of him, and Caitlin knew this and resented it, that welcomed the break from drudgery, from the kind of work he was doing in London. But again, that idea of self-loathing kicked in pretty quickly because he realised that he could never really write on tour.
Here's an extract from Andrew Lycett's biography on his first trip to New York. Dylan felt awful and vomited periodically, hardly a good augury for the first reading at the Poetry Centre that evening. 5 minutes before he was to appear, he was seized with a coughing fit and retched convulsively. Unable to see how Dylan could carry on, Brynin, his tour manager, had to help him to his feet. But as the curtains parted, Dylan braced himself, puffed his chest, and walked out in front of a capacity house of over 1,000 people. And of course, it was all a huge success. Perhaps in this episode, we can see where lies the wonder and the fraud.
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, he did talk about the economic side of things in America, but he was aware of the damage it was doing to him. I mean, he talks about the easy but killing money. Now, the fact that he actually says killing money, I think he is aware of the state of his own health. But at the same time, he obviously had very exciting plans for the future. You know, he was about to start work on an opera with Stravinsky, which he was really excited about.
So we can't call it suicide in any sense.
No, not at all. And I think he was terrified of death, yeah. And he wouldn't have wanted to think that he was going to die, but people who met him off the plane on that fourth tour, I think actually Brynin said retrospectively he already looked like a dead man walking.
Halfway through a dinner party, he got up, walked out, saying, "Somebody's boring me, and I think it's me."
Yeah.
His last public engagement was a lunchtime reading at the City College in New York. He slipped into a coma on November the 5th. An ambulance was called to the Chelsea Hotel, where he had a room. He died after 4 days, aged 39, as we've already said. Plenty of medical reasons have been offered as to why he died, but curiously, the post-mortem showed little damage to his liver. Do we know why?
Well, he's Welsh, isn't he? No. Well, there are all sorts of reasons. I mean, there has been the idea that the doctor who came to visit him at the Chelsea Hotel gave him an almost lethal dose of morphine. And there's still quite a lot of sort of a mystery surrounding those 4 days. I know that St. Vincent's Hospital is still very sensitive about this. You wouldn't want to be sued for the income that hasn't been earned by the Thomas estate, you know, for the last, or certainly by Thomas over the last 50, 60 years.
Because we tend, when somebody has died young, to take it, especially if they're a great achiever, to take it as the plot of a novel which, so to speak, has already been written before the final words are written down. And just to assume that he was always going to die, and it's part of what Dylan Thomas was, that he was going to die young. But what if he hadn't? What would he have done?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the last thing he wrote, as far as a big project is concerned, is obviously Under Milk Wood. And he would have gone into films, he would have gone into producing films, perhaps.
Yeah.
His own worry, of course, was that in 53 that he was leaving poetry behind. And he was always worried about that. He was always worried about whether the poetry would dry up or not. And was often in tears, literally in tears, because of that anxiety about poetry drying up.
I think he might have gone back to Wales. Famous letter to an early girlfriend reads, "It's impossible for me to tell you how much I want to get out of it all, out of the narrowness and dirtiness, out of the eternal ugliness of the Welsh people and all that belongs to them." I don't believe he really believed that, and I think he would have returned to the bosom of his country as he got older.
I think he was certainly looking for company. I mean, one of the tragedies of those final years is that a lot of his older friends had perhaps dropped away. He was travelling a lot. Caitlin had certainly stopped engaging with his internal world. So I think he was a very lonely man. So I think you might be right, because if he was looking for company, if he was looking for comfort, I think he always would have been led back to Wales.
What's his future, finally, Owen, as a dead poet, so to speak? What's the future of his reputation?
Well, I hope it's good, because you hope that good work, excellent work, you know, as Philip Larkin said when he died, he said three poets have changed the face of poetry in the English language, and the youngest of them has died. And he was talking about T.S. Eliot, Auden, and then Thomas, and that's extraordinary. He does have a huge readership. You know, all across Europe, as I said, you go to, I mean, New York now, that's still a city in thrall to his voice, and that is his achievement, is that he achieved such an individual, such a unique voice, and in such a short amount of time. So I hope that achievement will continue to be recognised.
My thanks to our expert, Damien Walford Davis, and to Owen Shears for choosing The Great Life of Dylan Thomas. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this Great Lives podcast. Many other BBC programmes are available as podcasts. You can find details at bbc.co.uk/radio4.